This is tape number 856, side 2, May 2nd, 1988, and I'm talking about the article in Barron's, part 2, Rogue Justice, Who and What Were Behind Vendetta Against Inslaw. Now, the quotations of the article are very powerful, and of course I always go off the record and add my interpretation to them, and I'll share some of the material that this author put in there, of course, with her words. And she says that the resignations that took place March the 30th, and there's been more since then, there's 10 that have resigned from the Justice Department, and the report of the special prosecutor that will be out very shortly, John McKay, will come closer to addressing the real question, what was there at the Justice Department, what was happening at the Justice Department during the past 4 years. And of course, 4 years ago is when I was describing the disaster of Edwin Meese and Ursula Meese and the gang around them from California. She said the Inslaw case is virtually an unpublicized window on how the Justice Department did their business during the Meese years. And the article I cited from the Examiner, that long article, is just one of very, very few. Even though this lawsuit has been pending for several years, she said it is an unpublicized window, which is a tragedy because this is the one department that shouldn't be protected from what it's doing. She said Judge George Basin made charges that the department committed. And quote again, I had them before, a willful and wanton and deceitful act, a series of acts demonstrating contempt both for law and for any principle of fair dealing. That's the Justice Department's contempt for the law. And she said Bill Hamilton, the founder of Inslaw, when he had his problems, believed that he only had one problem. He believed that C. Madison Brewer, the man that he fired earlier, was the cause for his problems in the Justice Department. But when he went to court, he realized it wasn't just Brewer that was doing this to him. That would be easy when he went to the court, June 9th, 1986. But when his trial progressed, the trial on the bankruptcy and so forth, he then began to see that Brewer wasn't solely responsible, that it was a policy not of a man that he had fired who had a vendetta, which is easy enough to handle, but it was the policy of the entire Justice Department and the team under him. And then the question is asked in the article, why did the Justice Department put Brewer, a man fired by Hamilton, into the critical position, which is highly improper, and allow him to remain? He had been fired by Hamilton way back in 76. What was he doing handling the contract later with a man he absolutely hated? And the judge was surprised at how much hatred he had against him. And the author of this article said, why did the Justice Department refuse to settle the case? As it opened up and the scandal went on, they refused to settle it. They kept going. And why were the government lawyers, they weren't just satisfying in bankrupting Inslaw, it's a company that they originally agreed to have the program, and the program was good enough to buy, why did they press to liquidate it, which is a totally different story than bankruptcy? The Hamiltons won their case by the end of 1987, but they still wanted to know what happened and why their company was in near ruin. And the interest was in the Justice Department, and he couldn't believe that they had selected people to wipe him out and take away his company. A comparison can be made in the publishing business or research business where they buy up a book, a good book, just as you buy up a computer company. Then the owner of the book doesn't advertise it or let you know it's available, and he throws it on the remainder table, and it's not seen, and it's sold out for $1 or $2, and people who would want it don't see it. And so they are purchased to be destroyed, and his system was purchased, and the man, in this case, the man was to be destroyed, and then the company would go in the hands of people who were ready and competing with him earlier to receive the losses. And again, this book that Don Fried wrote, The Secret Life of Ronald Reagan, was bought by Hutzler, and then it was never allowed to be seen. And in there were remarks, a page about Charles Willoughby, his really name is Wiedenbach, Carl Wiedenbach, from Hitler's Kriegs Academy, and how he was meeting with Dr. Loyal Davis. Dr. Loyal Davis was a neurosurgeon, Nancy's father, and Dr. Earl Bryan, a listener, a friend, told me, reminded me, was a neurosurgeon. And I wonder if Dr. Earl Bryan, who worked for Ronald Reagan, in the health and welfare in California and then made tremendous profits out of contacts with him had anything in common or knew Nancy Davis's father, the neurosurgeon. Now, Elliot Richardson is quoted in this article as being one of the attorneys who represented Hamilton to save his case. Richardson has been on television blasting Edwin Meese in the last few weeks. He said he should go. Richardson is also the attorney for the late Cyrus Hashemi, and he was involved, Hashemi, with meetings with Hakim and Secord and sending arms to Iran. And Elliot Richardson feels that even being part of the team, he was part of that Saturday night massacre when they left office, when Richard Nixon was creating the scandal in the Justice Department at the time of Watergate, and he started to represent Mr. Hamilton. But when Hamilton was working with the law office that Richardson came from, there were problems even in that law office. So the Hamilton started listing all the anomalies and tried to figure out what the mystery was. And they tried to organize all the things they saw until, according to this story, when you put them side by side, the story then fit together differently than just being knocked down with one surprise after the other as the company was hit, just like the Titanic hitting an iceberg, a successful company was falling apart. And the conclusion that I mentioned was that the massive cover-up was not just to protect Rick Brewer, but someone had persuaded Judge Blackshear, one of the judges in this case, to recant his testimony under oath within 48 hours of his original deposition. And the question was asked in this article, has the power to make a judge change his testimony in 48 hours from what he said before that? And according to this author, you don't do that to a federal judge. The Justice Department shouldn't be doing that to a federal judge, not to protect just Mr. Rick Brewer, who didn't like Hamilton. It has to be bigger than that. And then there was criminal liability at the highest level of the department. So Bill Hamilton thought about the matter and went back to what he said were early warnings about the Justice Department methods. Now, what he says here, and I'll recount that, a letter was sent to the editor of Barron's, and when I'm through with this article, I'll share that with you next week and show you the fallacies or holes in it. So I'm not going to repeat what was printed in the letters of the editor. I'm just going to tell you what was in this article. Mr. Hamilton said that as he looked back chronologically to what happened to him after he sold his company in 1982, that he got a telephone call in April 1983 and he didn't take it seriously. But it was a call from a man named Dominique Leite, L-A-I-T-I, who's chairman of Hadron Incorporated, Hadron Corporation. And on tapes 639, 641, 642, I'll get into them later, March of 1984, 4 years ago, I was doing a broadcast on Hadron Corporation and Dr. O'Brien and the links to Ursula and Edwin Meese. But the chairman of Hadron Corporation called the president, Mr. Hamilton, of his company and Inslaw, and said, do you want to sell your company? And at that time, this was just the time of the hearings on Edwin Meese for Attorney General, and Hadron's name had come up, and Dr. Earl Bryan's name had come up, and so forth. So he said, no, I'm not interested in selling it. I'm satisfied. And Mr. Leite identified himself, and he said Hadron intended to become the leading vendor providing software for the law enforcement nationwide, that it intended to become the leading vendor, and would you like to sell to us? Now, this was really scary, and Meese had direct links to Hadron. Hadron and Meese were involved with things in California, such as the Garden Plot, the Federal Emergency Management, the California Justice System, the military police, Squad 19, the L.A. Police Department. Meese was tied up to all the police computers of the military intelligence, the reserves, and the Army Reserves, and so forth, and the plot for emergency takeover of the country. And his friend from Hadron, the chairman, was saying that they were going to be the leading vendor for law enforcement nationwide. And Mr. Leite claimed that he had purchased SIMCOM, S-I-M-C-O-M, that was a police department software, and he also had purchased Acumedics, and this is important, Acumedics, a company that provides computer-based litigation support services for the courts. Now, Hadron said, we want to buy Inslaw, your system. And Inslaw had gotten the contract already with the Justice Department, and Hadron was represented by Meese's friends and wanted to own it. And Mr. Hamilton told Mr. Leite, the chairman, that his ambition so far to be the major vendor of the software services that he had the same ambition, and he said, we're not interested. And Lady, according to Hamilton, kept pushing and boasting and said, we have very good political contacts in the current administration. We can get this kind of business. Now, Attorney General William French Smith was just ready to leave the Justice Department in 1983 and make room for Edwin Meese to go in. Smith's law office represents the Los Angeles Police Department, the same police department that was feeding the computers of Western Gold that transferred from California, where they had a branch office, and I'm sure they still have Western Golds out there, right to Carl Spitz Channel as soon as Larry McDonald was killed on the KAL. And Meese knew, of course, and Ollie North knew, and these people knew, that the California Western Golds was being fed from the Los Angeles Police Department, and the attorney for the Los Angeles Police Department was the same man who was the attorney for President Ronald Reagan, William French Smith, and Reagan had made him the attorney general, so that the ties to Dr. Bryan and health, education, and welfare in California with Ronald Reagan and the LAPD files that were into those computers were, of course, important to the future police states and for getting biographies of people to get out of jobs, such as the Justice Department, to put moles in. So there was a lot of pressure here because this man wanted to control these computers, probably here and elsewhere, but the story involves this particular company. So Bill Hamilton, when he signed his contract, he said, we're not interested in selling. And Dominique Leite answered, according to Hamilton, we have ways of making you sell. Well, the other way of making you sell is not really to sell it, but to liquidate it and then receive it at the other end after you completely sabotage it. So a member of the Senate staff who's now involved investigating the Justice Department said, I would think that the whole tale was a fantasy. If I hadn't been involved in investigating the Iran-Contra affair, but now he's investigating the software contracts because he knows that there are no more fantasies after reading about these secret teams and the methods they have to operate and take over. Now, Hamilton said he remembered the call and he shrugged it off, and the chairman of Hadron was so aggressive that he didn't think anything about it, but he kept it in the back of his mind when everything came apart how bad it was. And from behind the scenes, the man who controlled Hadron was none other than Dr. Earl Bryan, a Meese crony from California days, and Rick Brewer, the project manager who was bitter about being fired, was working also with Earl Bryan and D. Lowell Jensen, then Deputy Attorney General, now a federal judge appointed by Reagan. This article says, a ghost from Inslaw's own California past had developed a software product to compete with Inslaw, and he lost it in 1970 in Alameda County, and that's Lowell Jensen, and I read some of a newspaper article about his background. And when Reagan became president, he appointed Jensen from Alameda County to be a top-ranked member of the Justice Department right under Edwin Meese. And when Bill Hamilton sat down in good faith and signed a deal to negotiate with the Justice Department, the people on the other side of the table were not, according to this author, dispassionate government officials. They were a hostile crew, inspired apparently by old scores to get even, one being fired, and with private business interests that wanted to buy his company or compete with it, couldn't buy it, and also they had an alternate system that wasn't sold to the Justice Department. So the game plan was get the best computer system you can find, sign and contract and buy it, offer to buy it from them. If they don't sell it, make them liquidate. Bankruptcy is not enough. Take the system for yourself. And the people that were being used for this were Ronald Reagan, Edwin Meese, the Attorney General, Mr. Jensen from California, the people that had worked with the Los Angeles Police Department, with Otto von Bolschwing, with Reinhard Gehlen, and the dirty tricksters that wanted to have their hand, indeed, in control of the police files. Not only, I'm sure, this isn't just for the state of California, but for the entire nation. This article in Barron's continues, the attack was successful for a while as the cover-up spread out to embrace the Justice Department, the IRS, the Attorney General Arnold Burns, the Deputy Attorney General Arnold Burns, the one that retired just March 30th, and he had become Lowell Jensen's successor, and they did what they called to circle the wagon. And again, the shocking thing about this story is that we're not talking, well, we are talking about organized crime and the mafia, As Martha Mitchell said, the mafia's in the White House. For that statement, she got a needle in her ass and a cancer that caused her death within a few years. But the technique is the very brutal technique of the mafia that have worked their way up, indeed, into the Justice Department. And the term is circled the wagon. And the Justice Department became the offensive person against this Mr. Hamilton, not defending his rights, but offensive, as described in Barron's Financial Weekly. They used their attorneys, a special attorney, the Justice Department whistleblower was destroyed, a member of a prestigious law firm was destroyed, one judge lost his job, another was forced to perjure under testimony, sworn testimony, and so forth, and the place became so corrupt. And this is what some people are saying, the Justice Department really can't function like this too much longer in this way. Now, Bill Hamilton was lucky, this is saying lucky, in that when the company was to be liquidated, the great taker was IBM, and they became Insull's savior to save his company from the auction block. Just several weeks ago on tape number 854, April 18th, I quoted some references of Paddy Chayefsky's story Network in the lines, "There is no America, there is no democracy, there is only IBM, ITT, ATT, and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbine, and Exxon. These are your nations of the world." Well, since I had that quote on the air, the president of AT&T died of a three-week cancer just one day before the annual board meeting, a very political situation that he had there. And this company, several years ago, was taken over by that other country, IBM, the company of Bill Hamilton. So in come the greedy arms of these corporations, and the word is rescued his company, but for all purposes, it belongs to IBM. So IBM came one of these nation buyers and took up the Insull contract. It wasn't a complete loss, but again, it gets swallowed to the major companies. Now, the Senate staffers looked into Insull, and they thought it raised a question about something called Project Eagle. And this is what I'm wondering is really dangerous, and the article gets back to Eagle later. They said that is a much larger scheme to computerize the Justice Department. This $200 million contract will be awarded at the end of 1988, and they're afraid that this is taking his company was to add it to Eagle. And Eagle possibly could be one of these major plans of the worldwide Odessa in the process of controlling the world. And it could tap into those major computer companies, six or eight of them, down in Austin, Texas, that Bobby Inman built. He was National Security Advisor and Director of the CIA, and he will have a big job and appointee as soon as either George Bush or Dukakis are in office. So I'm wondering if Eagle and this Justice Department mayhem will tap then into these major computers that literally can put all kinds of information from all over the world into those locations in Austin, Texas. The Barron article says the Insull problems remain magnified by the departure of these, at the time this was written, six people now. There's 10. Where did they go? How high does this go? And starting with Hadron, as Leahy boasted, they were well connected in the administration. And then it goes on to say Hadron is controlled by Dr. Earl Bryan, a long friend of Edwin Meese. Dr. Bryan also owns the Financial News Network, and he also bought up UPI recently and has the United Press International. The business dealings between Edwin Meese's family and Dr. Earl Bryan's company almost impaired the Meese nomination in 1984, and they get into that. Hadron, Bill Hamilton charges, is one of the keys to the mystery of why Insull became the victim of the rogue Justice Department. Hadron has a history replete with acquisitions. They make their money like vultures eating off of corpses. Hadron takes acquisitions. In this case, the Justice Department was forcing an acquisition so it could gobble up and own the company. And they have lots of government businesses, and they also have had brushes with the Security Exchange Commission. Hadron was born out of the ashes of a company called Zonix. And I'll do more when I finish the Barron's article to refresh your memory. Zonix had a contract with Edward Teller of Western Goals, with that's the massive computer system with John Singlaub and Admiral Thomas Moore and so forth. Zonix was to make Defense Department Star War machinery, and they were in trouble with Helionetics when it was March 23rd, 1983, when Reagan gave his Star Wars speech that Edward Teller wrote because Teller was part of Zonix and Helionetics, and the stock went up so high that they made hundreds of thousands of dollars in several days. And actually, the company later went bankrupt, Helionetics, because it was being investigated by the Security Exchange Commission. So this is a group of real opportunists surrounding the entire California Alameda Mafia and Ronald Reagan going back to early days and still profiteering for more expenses. Also on the board of Helionetics was William Simon, whose money from the Olin Foundation went to Albert Hakim, who came from Iran to the West Coast to buy International Imaging System, the Otto von Bolschring subsidiary. Those are the connections of these people, Zonix, to Helionetics, but I'll refresh your memory if you don't know those details later, but the implications here, I think you can see, are pretty high. And the article says, Zonix was a notorious high-tech fiasco, X-O-N-I-C-S, founded and headed by Bernard Katz, a colorful wheeler and dealer. Barron described Zonix in 1976 as a company with a knack for recognizing income as fast as possible and then deferring their expense as long as possible. In 1977, Security Exchange Commission had a lawsuit against Zonix. It accused them of top management, including Bernard Katz, of fraud, manipulation of stock price, and Zonix was the birthplace and the originator of the company Hadron that took over when the people went under and split and left the name Zonix behind. There were two shareholder suits that followed in 1971. The company didn't admit any wrongdoing. In 1979, Dominic Laity was asked to form Hadron after a group of former Zonix executives gathered together and decided they'd change their name from Zonix to Hadron. And by 1983, this company was lauded by the press as an investment banker's dream. And, of course, in 1983, Mr. William French Smith would step down, and the great opportunist Edwin Meese would be in the Justice Department, and his friend Earl Bryan would be part of Hadron with Mr. Katz, and of course with their power in Washington, it would be an investment banker's dream. Hadron inherited its parent, Zonix, with an acquisition streak, and it bought 9 companies in 3 years. It would be interesting to know what those 9 companies were that went bankrupt, but they bought them up in 3 years. And there were snags with the Security Exchange Commission in 1981. They ruled that limited partnerships in Hadron had been set up to fund their R&D efforts and were in truth really a form of loan financing, and this is technical. But Hadron at that time lost a $4.5 million lawsuit because of their machinations. And by 1983, Dominic Laity and the group were on a roll, and they went into the laser business. That's where they tie up with Helionetics into the laser business. And then there was a new potential. This was the Star Wars potential. And there's the potential for very, very, very rapid growth, because then they get into the military. And Edward Teller, unbeknownst to the regular Defense Department, had pulled his Star Wars activities with Ronald Reagan, who had been close with since Reagan became governor and went right away to visit Lawrence Livermore Lab. And then the very people to make the profits out of all of this were companies such as Hadron. In February 1984, Hadron was selling its money-losing laser equipment division, and then it put another $1.2 million into investments that went up and down, and now it is a very successful company. As successful, if you think the way they made their money, it's a little bit scary, but it's described as successful. Hadron was soon getting contracts from Uncle Sam, from the Pentagon. They got a fat settlement from AID, the Agency for International Development, and then they got a gigantic contract for the United States Department of Justice. They were chased all over the place by the Security Exchange Commission and by private lawsuits, but once they were in the government, then nobody touched them, and I guess the Justice Department is its own entity, its own private island, and you can't touch it. Now, Hadron's government contracts could be traced directly to Dr. Earl Bryan, Meese and Lowell Jensen's crony and Reagan's crony, who was the president of Zonix with Katz, the chairman. Bryan was the president of Zonix until October 77, when Zonix was taken over by Dominic Laity. But Dr. Earl Bryan had been president of Zonix, and he stayed on the board when it was transferred to Hadron. He slipped away from the company for 6 months because there was an injunction against it, but he was never charged with any crimes that the people in Zonix were charged with. Some of them were seriously penalized. 4 officers were forced to sign a consent decree. They were never charged. Brian was never charged, but four other officers were. But Dr. O'Brien and Dominic Leahy of Zonix, who took over Hadron, led the investor group and rescued Hadron from the ruins of Zonix. And then Brian began to manage this company. Dr. Earl Brian weaves in and out, and when things are bad, he leaves the company and he isn't named in suits. And when things go good and he gets government contracts, he's up on top, and he made enough money to buy UPI and a lot of other companies. Now, Dominic Leahy, the head of Hadron, is the man who called Bill Hamilton. He's the chairman of Hadron, who was born out of Zonix and the company making the government contracts. And then Dr. Brian's business developments began to grow, and he controls four of the six seats on Hadron's board. He's close to Reagan and Meese, of course. And so the company Hadron is controlled by Dr. Earl Brian, and it was their chairman that wanted to, for Brian, buy off the computer system that was made by Mr. Hamilton Inslaw that he refused to sell. In 1981, Dr. Earl Brian resigned from Hadron's board to divest himself of Hadron and to facilitate himself for further transactions. And as I say, he was busy buying up liquidated companies. And Brian was involved in his own business development company called Info Technology, Information Computer Data Banks, and also he was interested in Hadron. And by January 1984, 1 year after Hadron's president, Dominic Leahy, had called Bill Hamilton, Earl Brian was back on the board of Hadron. And I repeat this because this is a company that was born out of Zonix with defense contracts tied up to Star Wars. And Dr. Earl Brian was up there up through the 1987 annual report with Hadron. And they had sold in October 87 their Atlantic contract services to Infotech. And that information technology is the birth of his buying United Press International, which is a big jump. Dr. Earl Brian was never in the big bucks like Edwin Meese, but he could come up with big bucks, and he could buy up companies and rescue them and manipulate stocks. And the shareholders weren't sure that anyone in Hadron was making any money but Earl Brian. Now, starting in 1987, he started to make big money. He got a $1.6 million fee, which seemed big for him because he had bought lots of other companies, from what was AID, and he claimed there was a contract with Syria that didn't go through. And then he went into another business called Acumedics. That's a subsidiary. Now, Acumedics sounds more like medical because he was involved with all these various medical companies that I described several years ago, and so was Ursula Meese. And he bought these medical companies, so when he says Acumedics is a news media affair, I doubt if it's as much a news media as it has to do with medical experiments and medical companies. And when he bought this Acumedics, going way back into the early 70s, it was already a company that was functioning before it became part of Hadron. In those early years, Meese was involved with Ursula Meese in two companies that involved not only laser equipment, but biotechnology, one subsidiary, and a company involved with pap tests and cancer smearing and human biological products and the Food and Drug Administration. And I've run down quite a few times the medical connections of this gentleman and Mrs. Meese and their investments. So Acumedics is a company that was a subsidiary of Hadron, which began to get a $40 million contract with the Justice Department, and that is not very small when they get into a $40 million. The article in Barron said that Hadron was never able to acquire Inslaw, as I've mentioned several times before, and she repeats in the article, but when Hadron Acumedics signed a $40 million deal, this provided automated litigation support services for the Justice Department that involved the Land and Natural Resources Division. So the semi-mini crooks that never really faced the court and on the trail of bankruptcy changed their names and switched boards and so forth, then got a $40 million contract, which is a continuation of a 1983 contract. And this article says that Acumedics started doing business in 1970. The Acumedic title reminds me of the medical business that was started in 1970 when President Richard Nixon, with the help of Henry Kissinger, closed Fort Detrick to the biological and chemical warfare and turned it over to Litton Industries. Litton, a close associate of Meese and Lowell Jensen and Ronald Reagan and Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon. And then Litton Industries had the biological genetic unit at Fort Detrick, Maryland. At the same time when cancer or the disease took, the purpose of the Army then was to create a disease that would not respond to the immune system. I'm out of time now on this tape, so I have to stop, and I will continue with Acumedics in 1970 and the implications of Meese and Ursula and all these people in the medical biological field. This gave me...